Hello and welcome to Witch Bitches Review. I'm a created spirit modeled after an anime character, Phoenix Arcana Lightwood.
And I am the rising archetype of the morally dubious podcaster. I'm Siren Rex Fry. This is normally the show where two actual witches analyze and review representations of witchcraft in media and pop culture. But today, it is the show where one actual witch did a whole episode without me. And his name is Phoenix.
Yeah, so this episode of the podcast, I had, because I finally got to do something by myself without Siren interrupting me every 5 seconds.
And that must be a real challenge for you. No, I was going to, you know, do that stupid thing where you, like, pretend like you're mad and then you're not and it's a joke. Haha. I was going to do that, but then I thought maybe I would just awkwardly explain it instead. I'm fine.
I had the opportunity to talk to Nag Loki Shivanath, the author of A Spirit Work Primer, A Beginner's Guide for Streamlined Spirit Work. This is a really great book. I bought it at a local shop here in Chicago from Blake and Wake Malloway, who run a publishing company that published the book called Cross Crow Books. The description of the book is, learn how to commune with spirits. In A Spirit Work Primer, author and necromancer Nag Loki Shivanath shows us how to form strong relationships with the spirit world, making these allies accessible to all serious practitioners. Whether you're new to the art of magic or have been studying for decades, this book will prove to be a valuable resource, one that will be referenced time and time again. Step into the spirit world and learn how to develop your spirit senses, how to make offerings to the spirit world, how to safely engage in spirit possession, and how to practice spirit invocation. This was such a wonderful read. I can't recommend this book enough. I really, really enjoyed it, and it was so cool to be able to talk to the author.
Phoenix, how did you get the chance to meet the author of the book?
So I frequent the Malloway Rose shop a lot. They're really cool. Hi, Blake. Hi, Wake. How you doing? And they're listeners of our show. So I've been going to workshops there, and we just sort of realized who the other was as I was participating in some of their classes, and
wait,
we just got to talk in.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. So wait, so you went to a class at a occult shop, and you were recognized as a celebrity? Is that what you're saying, Phoenix?
I mean, I guess so.
That is so ridiculous.
It was really cool. We had like a little fangirl moment over each other. And it was just really fun. It was really fun. And I have since been going there quite a bit and talking to them. And we just decided that we really wanted to work on something together. And this is what came of that. This book just came out. It's been immensely popular. And yeah, I got the opportunity to talk to an author. This is the first interview we've done on WBR in this way, and hopefully not the last, because it was really fun, and I think it's going to be a really good episode for you guys.
I'm really excited to listen to it. My new thing I'm obsessed with right now is Pam Grossman's podcast, The Witch Wave, and it's just a show where a witch interviews other witches about whatever creative thing they're working on, and it has cracked me. So I'm actually super excited that you did an episode like this, because it's the only thing I care about is listening to these witch interviews. It's the only thing I care about in the world right now.
It was super cool. It was a wonderful time. Nag was great. Super down to earth, super approachable. What I really liked about this book, and I said this in the interview, is that it's super accessible. It's not... I mean, it draws from some like historical grimoires and methods and all sorts of different traditions, but it's broken down in such a way that it's not overwhelming and it's not overly mystified. It's really digestible material. And I just really liked it. And interacting with Nag was the same way. He was very accessible, very like easy to talk to. It was a really good interview. So I'm excited for you guys to hear it. But before we get into that, we have some stuff we want to talk about in terms of the show. Welcome to the inaugural episode of season 2 of WBR.
Oh, Phoenix, you really made it sound like I didn't have to be prepared for this. So now it's all special. I'll do fine.
I think that this episode, this interview, is kind of ushering in a new era for us in terms of what we feel we can do and the ways that we can expand as a team and as a show. I think we're both feeling a lot more invigorated. We've been working really hard on content.
Hell yeah. It's been fun. It's been a blast. You know, I really hope y'all will like the next few episodes we're about to release, because I had so much fun making them. But I also have a lot of really strong opinions in them, and I'm very curious to how that is going to come out.
Oh, well, what else is new? Yeah. Siren with strong opinions, groundbreaking.
I
know,
I didn't say I was nervous about it. I said I was looking forward to seeing what comes of it.
So, the next few episodes that are going to come out after this one are not about Charmed Season 2. However, we will be starting a discussion about Charmed Season 2 shortly after those episodes air. We have a lot of really cool stuff planned, and I'm really excited. I have been undertaking a behemoth of editing, so apologies for how long our hiatus has been, but we've been working hard for you guys and having a fucking great time doing
it. Fuck yeah. I'm feeling just really good about the fact that we have, like, created so much content lately, and I have not yet fucked it up.
I mean, me too.
I know you feel the same way. You know, I had a habit for a minute of canceling recording sessions, and Phoenix was super understanding about that and handled it very well. Anyway, but yeah, no, so I haven't fucked it up yet, and it's been great.
Yeah, I mean, we can get into that on the air. We were having some, like, behind the scenes, like, Alyssa Milano, Shannon Doherty drama.
Oh my god, who is who? Who is who?
I think it's gonna be a really witchin' and bitchin' season two.
Fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah.
I guess we could announce that we have some collaborative episodes coming up with guest stars, other podcasters, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we're really stoked to have more people on the pod. We are networking, reaching out, and just really having a great time talking to you guys, talking to other people, and just continuing to read the shows we love for filth. And that's something that we didn't really get to do in this episode. I just loved the content that we were discussing. And that's something that I want to do a little bit more too, is discuss, like, real world occult media, because that's what a lot of times influences the shows that we watch, is books about witchcraft.
Books about witchcraft to me are representations of witchcraft in media and pop culture. Like, that's our thing. A nonfiction witchcraft book still falls into that category for me. So I feel like it's in our wheelhouse, and I also feel like we can do whatever we want.
We can do whatever we want.
Because no matter what it is, it's going to be witching and bitching.
Without further ado, let's get into this wonderful episode, and we'll talk to you guys later.
Hey, Phoenix. Thanks for including me in the episode I did nothing for.
What else is new?
You bitch.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Well, hello. I am really excited that you're here today. This is my first interview with an author. I've never done this before, so I'm really excited to have you on the show today, Nog. Do you want to say hello to the people?
Hi, people. I'm not as intimidating as I might sound.
You sound different than what I expected you to sound like, to be honest. I don't know what I was anticipating. I was anticipating like a low, gravelly sort of like...
The low gravelly part only comes out when I get frustrated or occasionally during ritual. It's kind of become my default. I don't know how familiar you are with like ceremonial magic and the idea of vibrating holy names. I had no idea what vibrating a name meant when I was younger. That was just what I defaulted to, was a real low, like, and I was correct. I found out years later.
It's that intuition that a lot of witches have, especially when they're first starting out, when you feel like you don't know what you're doing, but then when you look into it, it's like, oh, what I thought was the way to do that was actually correct.
Yeah.
So we're the Witch Bitches Review Podcast, right? So we're typically like pretty catty, and I'll spend a good like amount of time like writing jokes and planning on what I'm gonna make fun of and whatever we're talking about. But I'm just really excited to talk about this book with you, because I thought it was so well done. And it was I'm not a big reader, right? And that's not something that I've ever been super successful with. Most of the books that I buy stay unfinished. And that was not the case with this one. I fully could not put it down. So let's talk a little bit about A Spirit Work Primer. I really, really liked the way that everything was presented in a really easy to grasp and accessible way. It was just really, really digestible in a way that some other books on the topic have not been. What was the process of writing that like? What was your motivation in approaching the subject that way?
Well, you know, I've been a practicing magician since I was 12. So for 18 years, if anybody wants to do the math on that. But I remember when I was younger, you know, I started out with the easier things. Scott Cunningham, mm-hmm. DJ Conway, Silver Ravenwolf, things like that. And I really liked how easy some of it was written. I was also partially infuriated at times because they would throw references to things out there that, you know, a Wiccan that has been doing this for a while might know, or a magician who's been practicing would know. But I, as, you know, 13, 14 year old me, had no idea. Like, I had to either Google it or cross-reference it or find something that would illuminate what I was looking into. With the sole exception of Silver Ravenwolf's Teen Witch kit I got for Christmas, I was very appreciative. Looking back now, like, Silver Ravenwolf has her own issues. Not gonna go any further on that. But
yeah,
that one was written more towards my type of, you know, my reading level, let's say. And between that, between my professional work and, you know, other places I've taught at and interviewed at, I've found that it's valuable to not take for granted that my audience is going to be, you know, a seasoned magician who is looking for something as a reference tool, and instead to present things as, you know, I am just going to assume out the gate that this is your first magic book and I'm going to try and explain it like that. So that was what I did with this. Is I went back through everything that I've referenced on the topic before. I went through back through my own courses and classes that I've taught. I went through courses that I've taken, and I tried to condense everything down into a single volume that you could look into, but also something that you didn't have to pick out four other books in order to understand. And I actually put this book out, its first edition, 5 years ago, I think, back in 17.
Mm-hmm.
I even had questions back then about some of the things that I put in there. So I tried to clarify things when I did the second edition to avoid that problem further.
So was that the initial inspiration for this work, was the ability to compile your experiences and present this information in a way that was like sort of a one stop place for people building this practice for themselves?
Exactly. I would not say that I am only a spirit worker. You know,
mm-hmm.
having my inaugural book being about spirit work might cause people to have that assumption, but I do a lot with spirits. You know, my primary practice is essentially necromancy. You know, everything that I do, whether it is my tantric work, my work with Kimbanda, or my, you know, more generalized work, on some level is necromantic in nature. So spirit work is a big part of that. And I wanted to put together something that, you know, you could put your hands on, and by the time you got done, you were ready and able to conjure your spirits. Because there are a few other books on the topic, you know, that not many that are devoted specifically to general purpose spirit work, but there are some. But they are either extremely niche, or they're practically unreadable, or they're just full of nonsense. Like, I don't like, especially in a public forum, to say that another practitioner's practice is invalid. But there are some things that I just avoid being involved with simply because they are written as though the author intends for you to read the whole book and then say, oh, I have everything I need except for this one incense. Let me find a recipe. Oh, you can't find a recipe. You have to go buy it from the author. Mm-hmm. And then they tell you, oh, but you're going to need this. You're going to need this. You're going to need this. You know, a lot of books I've read have come out that way, like the Temple of the Vampire. I'm not sure if you're familiar.
I have not. I'm not familiar with that one, no.
They are essentially a branch off of the Satanic Temple. They focus on vampiric practice, and their teachings are sound, but in order to advance through the ranks of the temple, you have to buy their books, but you have to buy it from them. If you get it elsewhere, it's supposedly not going to work. That was what I wanted to get away from with this book. I wanted you to take this book, and if you were self-sufficient, you could forge all the tools in your backyard and not have to spend a penny with anybody else and still be able to do effective spirit work with pretty much any spirit you wanted to work with. I feel like I've done pretty decent with it. There are things I could have done different, but for a starting point, I'm personally happy with it.
I love the book. I could not put it down, and I'm not just saying that because I am talking to you right now. I've told that to every single person that I have talked to about this book. It really is a practical guide. So often I have found when occult authors are discussing working with spirits, they tend to get a little overzealous and overcomplicate the process a little bit. This wasn't like that. This had an entirely different attitude to anything that I have ever read on spirit work before. And it's something that I have sort of been a bit trepidatious to get into because of the way it's presented so often. But this really is a toolkit, not just an instruction manual, which I really enjoy about it. It's set up in such a way that you manage to approach spirit work in a way that still draws from historical methodology, but still make it accessible and allow it to translate to the individual's practice and worldview. Tell me a little bit about your process with that. How has your experience working with spirits differed from some of the resources that you pulled from when you started this work?
Well, a lot of people don't know this about me. I have a hard and fast rule that I can never be the smartest person in a room. So I'm always taking courses or reading books. And for the past 7 years, I have been in a tantric apprenticeship. I have 1 year left before I'm officially, graduated. But for the past 7 years, my mentor has drilled into my head the idea that, we overcomplicate things. That is what we do as a race, as a religious movement, as a spiritual movement. We overcomplicate things. We feel like going into the backyard, clapping your hands and saying, "Hey, protect me while I go on this trip," that's not magical. That's mundane. You have to ring the bell and light the candles and say the right words for it to be magical. And that is not his viewpoint at all. His viewpoint is it's magical if it works. So that is part of the approach that I took with this particular book. But I essentially wanted to get rid of the overcomplication with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted to demystify some things. Like, I feel like I make it clear in the book, but I am not one of the people who will say, "Oh, initiation is nonsense. You can practice whatever." That's not the case. I believe very highly in initiation. Like, if you're going to practice a closed tradition, then you need to be initiated. You need to do the things. I have a kind of a middle ground stance on it. Like, if you're white and you want to practice voodoo, technically you can if you are initiated. But, if you go to the house and they say, "No, we won't initiate you," then that's not a house for you. That's just my viewpoint on it.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is initiation. Like, do the things the right way. Because these cultures are so mystified, there is a lot of misinformation on them. Mm-hmm. I wanted to kind of get rid of some of that. Like, it's not... A lot of people in the online occult community especially are like, "Oh, I made this offering to, Maman Brigitte." Why? Like, you don't have a connection to her. There's no point in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
She's at best going to ignore it. But Papa Legba, being the opener of ways, he can be approached by anyone. So yeah, make an offering to him. And I also wanted to cut out a lot of the psychobabble we put into it. We like to, like the Goetia, people think that you have to have like a special room set aside, you have to do these things. And in a way they're correct, but not in the way they're thinking. So between all of that, I wanted to apply those same thought processes to my own ritual work. And I actually went through several conjuration rituals of various kinds to make sure I was on track, and then compare those with notes that I've been taught to make sure that, you know, when I was instructing this art, I was doing it in a way that you could take my invocation of the Morrigan I put in there, cut out all the references to her, paste in references to Aphrodite and exchange your correspondences and still do the same ritual, and it worked. That was the process.
You definitely achieved that. You approach every topic in the book with such reverence and a lot of respect while still making it relatable and, like you said, demystifying some subjects. One of those things that I wanted to talk about was your classification of spirits. I really liked how you avoided giving them too much morality, like using hot and cold for an example, for a classification of spirits. Can you tell me a little bit about what that process was like, why you chose the terms that you chose in working with the spirits in the book?
Sure. That classification is actually a combination of different systems, believe it or not. Part of it is taught by Jason Miller in his courses. Part of it is taught by, you know, my own house in voodoo and in Kimbanda. And part of it is just, for me, it's, I wouldn't say common sense, more like it is learned experience. So like, I have greater and lesser spirits, which to me, the definition of a greater and a lesser spirit is, if I say the name Belial or Belial or however you say it, you're familiar with that demon, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That would be a greater spirit. He is well known enough and widely known enough that, you know, he can be contacted. Meanwhile, to me, lesser spirits are something like the spirit of the tree in my backyard, or the shades of the dead I keep in my altar. Those, you wouldn't know them unless you happen to be related to one of them, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
But they're still spirits. They're effective. They work for me. They achieve things and they get their offering. Then we have dark and light spirits. Is not necessarily equated to good and evil. And I've harped on this for years and years and years. But to me, a light spirit is someone that is a spirit that is more attuned to benevolence and beneficence than maleficence. I would classify like the archangel Raphael as a light spirit because he is more about healing. I think that's correct. I don't do much with angels, to be honest, but he is more of a healing spirit, so he's more of a light spirit, whereas, you know, again, Belial is more of a dark spirit because, you know, he has no problem dishing out pain if he has to.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have your hot and cold spirits. That definition is widely used in the ATRs to refer to spirits that work fast versus slow. And I think I break it down in the book a bit, but essentially a cold spirit is one that is, when you call them up and you say, hey, I want this done, they might stop and say, but is that in your best interest? You know, is this something that's going to serve your needs? Whether it is or isn't, they can still be compelled to do the work. But ultimately, they're the ones that are going to be like, you know, you need to reconsider. Mm-hmm. Or they're going to work things out to where you may not get exactly what you asked for, but it's going to come out, you know, for your good. Whereas hot spirits, they just want to go. They want to get it done, whether it hurts you or not.
Mm-hmm.
No. And then finally, I have the isolated and global dichotomy. And this is one that Jason Miller goes into. But it's very similar to lesser and greater for me. There's some subtle nuance, but essentially an isolated spirit is one that when you conjure this spirit, it is in a single place. It is not capable of being in multiple places, but a global spirit is. So for instance, E.A. Coetting in his books, he has a lot of spirits that may or may not be made up. We're not going to go into that right now, but these may be global spirits in that multiple people could conjure them at the same time. But in my opinion, they're still lesser spirits because they don't have nearly the collective subconscious feeding into them as someone like Asmodeus or, you know, Lucifer.
That was something that, those were terms that I had never heard before. I had like a concept of that, and that was sort of how I viewed spirits in the first place, but I had never had like words for that before. And so that was really cool for me to read these classifications and sort of like get a little bit more context for things that, you know, people will make references all the time without any explanation. What I really, really liked about your book in terms of the information that you presented, especially about the classifications of spirits, is that you took the time to say what you meant. I have read, there's one book in particular that I don't want to use the name of on the air, where the author, reading it, it was such a hard book to get through. It took me like nearly a year. And I ended up having to just listen to the audiobook version, but he was so much more focused on being a good writer than being a good teacher, and making it like really mystifying and sort of like, and it just made it really inaccessible and fanciful and charmed LARPy to me. And that just wasn't what I was looking for out of it. And your work has really, really done that in a very successful way. And I thought that the classifications were just on point, and maybe it's because they aligned with things that I already thought, but I really liked it. I did.
Well, the that's the thing with spirit work is I have not created anything new in this. That's not true. The Grimora spirits at the end are spirits that I contacted. Those are not pre-existing. They're technically lesser spirits if we want to go with the classifications.
Mm-hmm.
So I contacted those. But other than that, I didn't create anything. All I did was compile, condense, and clarify material, because after so many decades of occult authors, all the information's out there. It's just being rehashed.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that going in. I knew writing this originally that what I'm doing is not new. It's not original. The only original thing I did was cut away the so-called blinders and try to demystify things so that, you know, when you read it, instead of going, oh, I have to draw out a hexagon on the ground to conjure the spirits of the sun. No, you just need to have a delineated space.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lot of what I was working towards with this. So, you know, if you're reading through this and you may see a bit of information here that sounds kind of like something you heard elsewhere, or, you know, a classification that looks kind of like something you read here. Yeah, you probably did, but those two aren't going to be the same book. Now they're in one place.
So this is, I'll probably move this around in the post-production, but this is backtracking a little bit. We've talked a lot about your work in the book, which is what this interview is about, but what drew you to magic in the first place? What started you on this path?
That is a very anticlimactic answer. When I was a wee lad of, you know, about 11, 12, something like that, we watched, I want to say it was like the Merlin movie with the guy from Dragonheart, Sam Neill.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, I grew up in a two-parent home. I lived with my father, who was very conservative Christian, but I spent time with my mother, who was more liberal in her views. And I happened to mention, like, man, that would be cool to be able to do magic like that. Not knowing, growing up literally in the Bible Belt buckle, that there were choices outside of being a godless heathen or being a Christian. Well, my mother seized on that statement, and for Christmas that year, I opened two books. One was Earth, Air, Fire, and Water by Scott Cunningham.
Oh, I love that
Highly
book.
Highly recommend. Oh, it's great.
I love that book.
So great. And Norse Magic by DJ Conway. It's basically Wicca with a Norse coat of paint, but it was a start. And from those two books, it just kind of grew from there. In my time as a minor, you know, before I had adult money and could do adult things, I had collected, besides those two books, I had Michael Hewitt's book on astral projection, I believe, or no, Michael Hewitt's book on psychic abilities, I think. I had Edane McCoy's book on astral projection. I had Oberyn Zell Ravenheart's Grimoire for the Apprentice Wizard. I had Cornelius Rumstuckle's guide for the Apprentice Wizard, or something. I don't know. Basically, it was colorful energy work. It's not important. I had Simon's Necronomicon. I had Simon's companion for the Necronomicon that was the 50 names. I had Constantinos's Nocturnal Witchcraft. That was one of my favorites, in case anyone was wondering. That one was top tier for me. I can't remember any of the other ones offhand, but then there was an incident and all of my books got thrown out, and I had to wait until I had adult money again to start rebuying.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so I spent probably 3 years doing nothing but meditating and doing energy work, making prayers and performing silent invocations. I got real good at spirit work at that point, because it's not like I could make a poppet, you know?
Right, yeah.
But the first thing I did when I got adult money and got my adult house was set up a temple with an altar and start rebuilding my collection. So I think I've done pretty good. I've got some very difficult to find books on that shelf in there now. But yeah, it all started with Scott Cunningham and DJ Conway.
That's amazing. And so often I feel like, I mean, with my co-host and I, who's not recording with us today, we both, our first introductions to witchcraft were in like the late 90s with Charmed and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and things like that. I feel like media is so often the gateway for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
But it's great that you had at least that moment of support to start you on this path, because not only have you rebuilt, but now you have your own book out there, which is just super duper cool. Let's talk about some of the topics that might cause a little bit of discomfort for people with the book. Very specifically, in chapter 7, you talk about spirit possession. There's a lot of discomfort and misunderstanding around this subject. Where do you think that comes from? And what advice would you give to your readers to put them at ease a little bit?
So possession has gotten a bad rap in the West. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of this movie, but it's called The Exorcist.
Yes.
And it has not helped the image of spirit possession in the modern world. Add to that, you know, all the accounts that come out of Haiti of people eating tumblers while under possession and just doing things that are absolutely like impossible. They're impossible for a human to do. They do them when they're being ridden by Loa. So you have these reports rolling in. Combine that with the modern materialistic mindset of, if it's not right in front of me, it's not real. You have a lot of fear built up around possession. And there's no easy way to break it. I mean, to be honest, the best advice I can give is meditation. Like, you're not going to get possessed and have your head start spinning around and crawling up walls. Like, that is not, that does happen. I have personally seen things like that. You know, I've spent some time in places where spiritual activity was so high that exorcisms weren't like an unknown topic. They were a weekly thing. So I have seen people slither on the ground like snakes. I've seen people crawl up walls. I've seen people who do not know English have a conversation with me. I've seen things, but those are not what happens when you willingly enter the possession. When you're entering a possessive state, you're not stepping out of the car and giving the keys to someone else. You are scooting over to the teacher driver seat and letting someone drive the real seat. You still have a brake pedal you can press. And that's what people need to understand, is that when you're doing a possession, you still have full control. You know, you still are able to not say something if words are trying to come out of your mouth that probably shouldn't right then. You're perfectly capable of ending that state. So the best advice I could give to anyone who is perhaps feeling some trepidation about undergoing their first possession is to realize that, number one, you're choosing your co-pilot. Like, this isn't something that is just happening. So, you know, maybe choose a spirit that's more well known for giving advice and helping people than one that's known for tearing their heads off. And number two, realize that once you've taken the co-pilot chair and they're driving, you still have that brake pedal. Like, nothing in my book by itself is going to get you hurt unless you just mess it up that badly. And at that point, like, I'm not responsible.
So essentially, have a little bit more faith in yourself and give yourself the authority in the situation.
Yeah. And the other half of that too is the part that most people don't want to hear, is if you're that afraid of something like that happening during a possession, you're not strong enough to do the possession anyway. Like, the bottom line, it's one of those, if you have to ask, you can't afford it questions. You know, it took years of practice for me to be able, not even to be possessed, but to just let go and just be a channel. So by that point, it wasn't that I was scared of it. I wanted it so bad and was so frustrated that it hadn't happened yet that it clicked over. If you're still that terrified of the possession, you probably have nothing to worry about anyway.
So you identify as a necromancer. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So necromancy is another one of those really charged topics due to just our, in my opinion, our westernized fear of death. It's a very Western culture thing to fear death in that way. Why choose that word? What about necromancy spoke to you? And what led you to having that as a title?
It's a combination of things, really. One of the big ones is, of course, that exact reaction. When someone says, I'm a magician, okay, well, you do card tricks. You know, you do coin tricks. You could pull a rabbit out of your hat. You say, I'm a necromancer. There is a very clear definition of what that is, which is often misconstrued, you know, but point of fact is, if I say I'm a necromancer, you know that in some way corpses are involved like that. There's no way around that. In fact, I raised this point, I think, in this book. I raised it in a couple courses I teach. I raised it in at least one other interview I can think of off the top of my head. Necromancy has to have the dead. If you are doing necromancy, and that means that you are summoning up some god that is associated with death, you're not doing necromancy. So there's a very clear definition of what it is. And for me, that definition is important to my work. But the main draw of why necromancy is I've always felt a connection to graveyards, mausoleums, crypts, you know, places of death. I didn't understand it much when I was younger. I just knew like they were cool. I wanted to go there. I wanted to hang out there. You know, I wanted to spend time at certain headstones for some reason and learn about their history. So I had that fascination and that draw. And I think my first real brush with actual necromancy outside of, you know, the usual build an ancestral altar and be sure to honor your ancestors when you make your other offerings, was I think Constantinos is the one that mentions it. It started me down that road because it brought up a concept that is very much alive in the Day of the Dead celebrations, which is, you know, as long as someone remembers you, you're still alive in the other world. And that kind of hit me hard enough that I said, well, if that's what keeps these people in this world, then I'll be that person. Because I don't really hang out at people buried in the 90s. You know, there's one spirit, I think, on my altar that was from 1917. Everything else is like 1800s back. These spirits are older. They've been around longer. They have wisdom I don't have. And they don't probably have any living relatives who even remember their name. So it's important for me to keep that connection, to keep them alive. And that's a lot of what being a necromancer is for me, is not being the big, bad, scary man who throws around bones and drinks corpse water. It is, it smells terrible. I actually picked some up from Blake and Wick when I was up there, and it smells awful. But I focus less on being that guy and focus more on caring for my spirits, keeping up my local graveyard, and educating people and pointing people back to their own ancestors. And there is another author, again, can't remember the name, but they raised the point that of all the spirits, and I think I mentioned this in the book, of all the spirits you may work with, the only group of spirits who will always 100% have your back are your ancestors. Because it doesn't matter how much favor you have with your local spirits, it doesn't matter how much favor you have with your gods and your demons and whatever else, your ancestors have an invested interest in your well-being. You are the culmination of millennia of their lives boiled down to a single point. Why would they not want you to succeed? And being a magician, success is important, you know? So
that leads to another question. And this is more of like a personal question. And I've talked about this on our pod before. We have, and we talked about sort of ancestors of communities you belong to, specifically like our queer ancestors, those who fought for our liberation. I had a very tumultuous relationship with my parents. And obviously ancestor work can go back much further than that. But for someone like me, who kind of shies away from my family lineage, what advice would you give to someone like that?
The first one is, yeah, absolutely. And in a great way, we choose our ancestor. If you get initiated into a house, you know, into a religion, into a practice, you're grafted into that. That's what initiation is grafting you into that spiritual bloodline. You have all these generations of priests and sorcerers and spirits and everything else behind you when you get grafted in by initiation. And, you know, to add on to that, like I get the question all the time, you know, I'm adopted. What about my ancestors? Well, you may not know your blood ancestors, but you know the ancestors that took you in. They count just as much. You can still work with those adopted currents, whether it is the bond of friendship, the bond of, you know, adoption, initiation, you know, communal choice. You still have those people behind you. You still have that spiritual backing. And while you're in their community, you're still, you are walking in the path they laid out. So they're still going to have your back. I have family members that I do not care for, didn't care for them in life, really don't have much to do with them in death, but they're still ancestors. So I still keep them on my altar. And you don't have to like them. You don't even have to love them. But it's like they say about history, you know, history is there for us to learn from, not to ignore. They get their offerings. They get told to stay in their corner, essentially. Some people have family members that are absolutely terrible, but they are still ancestors. When it comes to that situation, there are ways around having to deal with it, but it's best usually just to leave the offering, and then you don't even have to thank them for their presence. Leave the offering, move along.
Also in the chapter about spirit possession, you talk about channeling a principle during possession. I personally was confused by that. What does that mean?
I figured that would be, and there's no easy way to explain this. So this comes back to my first channeling experience. At the time, I was apprenticed to someone who was obsessed with this. I suppose you could call it a being, but it wasn't sentient. It wasn't conscious. For a frame of reference, I don't know if you're a Star Wars fan or not, but I'm sure you're at least familiar with the idea.
I know of Star Wars, but for a witch, I am remarkably disinterested in space. So
hashtag recommend. But this is from a lifelong Star Wars nerd, so take that with a grain of salt. But you're aware of the concept of the Jedi and the Force.
Yeah.
The Force could most easily be likened to the concept of the divine flow, the Eao, the nameless, faceless God essence, whatever you want to call it. She had made contact with something kind of like that, except instead of being at best neutral, this thing was at best nihilistic and openly malicious. We referred to it as negation. It was, if you could put a face to a black hole, that would be kind of like what it is. And she was obsessed with it when I was studying under her briefly. She would channel it. And maybe this is why I had such trouble learning to channel originally, because I was channeling a principle, a concept, versus a being that could talk and have words and do things. It was like trying to explain to someone who's been blind their whole life what the color red is. As a concept, as a principle, negation didn't have use for language. That is the purpose behind that say. That's the story. You can channel concepts like love and compassion and hope, but you're going to have to interpret something that doesn't speak in human language.
Okay. So like, it's sort of like, this is a really, really simplified version, but like a one word mantra, like love. It's, what does that mean in a grander sense?
Yes, exactly.
Bringing that into yourself. Yeah, okay. Gotcha. See, that's what I had assumed.
It's kind of like an interpretive dance in reverse. Instead of having an idea in your head and then expressing it through dance, you have a very abstract flow and you are trying to condense it into something intelligible.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense in a weird way. Right? Like that just like made it click in my brain. So my favorite chapter of the book was chapter 11, Uncreated Spirits. I think that this might be the first time that I have ever seen the process of creating a servitor laid out so directly. Because I've heard the word a lot. I have understood the concept, but I have never seen the steps like anywhere before. So that was really cool in my, you know, like nerdy sort of like, I want to work with a Digimon spirit kind of way.
Funny you mentioned that. That was one of the first things I ever made.
That's amazing. Let's talk about the Digimon thing. That's awesome. Let's dig into that.
So the method is a combination, again, like Austin Osmond Spare talks about his ways to do it. I don't think Spare ever really lays out that when creating a sigil, you're creating a servitor. That's what you're doing. There's Spare's method. There's Miller's method. There's the tulpa method, which, you know, obviously, unless you're using the proper mandala and ritual, it's not a tulpa. I'll harp on that for years. There's the golem method. For me, the planetary method is one I learned a while back that I'm personally fond of, because I like the idea of having a letter grid. Like, there's a theme to my practice, which is I like something I can put my hands on. When it comes to divination, yes, I could read cards, but I like geomantic oracles, whether it's the wands, the dice, coins, whatever. I like things I can put my hands on and throw. With servitor creations, the same way. I want to make a body out of clay or metal or whatever else I happen to have on hand, and I want to imbue it with my essence that way. And when I'm creating the sigil, I want to lay out this square and draw it out in a way that is precise, as opposed to I can't do abstract. So that's the method I presented in the book. And then the planetary chemia method of it, you know, is useful because you're adding in that planetary impact. If you're wanting to create a servitor for love, you can use any square you want, but you could use the Venus square and add that extra kick to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That method is potent enough and useful enough. That's the main one I chose, but there are oodles of ways. But as for things I've made, I've made more servitors than I care to admit, but the Digimon. So when I was younger, I was a fan of Digimon Adventures, which is back on Hulu, and my kids refused to sit down and watch it with me because I apparently get too into it.
I just watched it this morning. Like, literally, it was what I ate. I was eating Frosted Flakes and watching Digimon this morning as I was prepping for this interview. So I'm just tickled as pink as Biomon that we're talking about this right now.
I was always a fan of Agumon, you know, because who wasn't?
Right.
I always had like that little guy syndrome for Patamon. And then when he finally breaks down and goes full Angemon, like, it's a triumph moment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I designed a servitor that was styled around Patamon, except that I didn't build the Digivolutions into it. I made him because I thought the design was great and I like Patamon as a character. So I built Patamon to act as my familiar. And then about 6 months later, I forgot about him. And, you know, he lived in the ether, I guess. I don't know. And then about a year after that, I was going back through my old notebooks and found some reference drawings and notes I'd made and said, oh my God. So I summoned him back and he had apparently stayed in the area, kept an eye on things, but continued to grow to the fact point that his form was no longer Patamon's. It was more bipedal, which at that point I was like, well, if you're not going anywhere, you know, might as well hang out. But yeah, we've at that point focused on growth and evolution, and there's no solid form he keeps now, just because I've made it a point to work with him on so many different aspects that there is no one form that fits his function. It's just whatever is most useful at the time. So that's probably my longest running personally created servitor, but I've created house guardians whose sole purpose is to keep the house safe, and some that are made to keep it hidden, and those work well enough that GPS has a lot of trouble finding my home, which is weird because I live in the middle of town. My favorite one is no longer technically a servitor. It's more in the realm of egregore at this point, but I was in the middle of one of the infamous witch wars that everyone always talks about and no one actually has much experience in. I was so devoted to taking out my enemy at that point that I bought a steel plate and I engraved it in, or cut it down into a circle, and I engraved my sigils into it. But I built a warrior servitor, and his sole goal was to mess up my opponent's life as much as possible, to replicate as fast as possible. And then, you know, once everything is done, all the replications collapse back into the original, making him stronger every time he gets used. And then I made it a point to make sure as many people as possible got a hold of him for their purposes, just to make sure he was strong enough that when I called on him, my enemy was finished. Probably, I've still got the plate, like, hands down, favorite servitor.
So the last point about the book itself that I wanted to talk about, I really wanted to discuss the chapter on spiritual defense and cleanup.
Mm.
I really love that you saved this section for the end of the book.
There was a design choice there.
There's so much misinformation and fear-mongering about spirits perpetuated by multiple sources in the media, multiple cultures, by Christians. I feel like leaving this section to the end allows the reader to learn and work with the information presented without getting too caught up in the charmed LARP mentality that I talked about a little bit earlier. That idea that every like non-human, non-Western, non-white spiritual force needs to be treated like a threat or a danger. I liked that choice. Was that the motivation for saving that chapter for last, to allow people to open up and grow without that sort of innate fear?
In a way, yeah. I guess this is presumptuous of me, but I assume immediately that anyone who buys my book is going to read the whole thing first and then start working. The idea behind putting it at the very end was to hit you with all this information, right? You're learning about how to summon a spirit. You're learning how to bring a spirit into yourself. You're learning to conjure spiritual companions and have familiars and create spirits. And then when you've learned to do all of this, now you learn to put all your toys away and go back to normal life. Like, the idea behind putting it at the end was that's the last step you do anyways. Might as well have it at the end. But also, it is a good way to close everything out because you are now spiritually cleansed. You've done the work, whatever. You flip to the end of the book. You do your cleansing and your banishing. And you close the book and you're done. That's it. That's the end. I made an intentional choice with the lesser banishing ritual, the pentagram, being in there specifically. Because it's effective, first of all, whether you use the original Christian version or like I talk about at the release party at Blake and Wick's shop, you can use the Christian version or there are plenty of alternatives. Doesn't matter which version you use, the symbolism, the movements, everything about it is such a powerful gesture that it's going to work. I also put it in there because it's Judeo-Christian. I don't have much for those mythologies myself. That is not a tradition I work in. I can't even really work with saints. If you are coming from a Judeo-Christian background, you're branching out to spirit work, it may give you some sense of comfort to when you're trying to put all these things back in the box, if you're really that worried about them following you home, so to speak. Maybe some familiar imagery will help allay those fears. And if you're not coming from a Judeo-Christian background, then you're probably not nearly as terrified anyway. But familiar imagery, again, The Exorcist, you know, that's the movie. There's not a pagan version of The Exorcist. It's a Roman Catholic priest with a cross and the holy water and the words. And this is about as close as most of us ever get to that point.
So let's talk about how you published the book. What made you choose Cross Crow? You were just talking about the release party at Blake and Wick's. Let's talk about the publishing company. What made you choose them to publish your book? And what has your experience been like? How do you feel about how your book's been received so far, if you're aware of what the reception is like?
I am, actually. We've had a few discussions about it. I wasn't seeking to do a second edition. Like, I had bounced the idea around casually, you know, maybe I'd go back and do some revisions and edit some things that both myself and my wife missed on the initial edit, but it was never something that I really had the time to put into, you know, between regular mundane life, my 9-to-5 and my shop. I didn't have the time for it. And then I guess Blake found it. And they had just opened up Cross Crow. The only book they put out was Blake's book. And he said that was, you know, he wanted to have a publishing company, but you can't really do that without something to publish. So he published his. They approached me and said, you know, we really like the book. It is on the level that we want to offer in our shop and in our publication. You know, and we don't know anybody else that's wrote on this. Will you do it? And I pretty much accepted that that was a sign from the gods that, okay, now it's time. So, you know, I took them up on that, and they have been such wonderful people to work with through the whole process. I'm not sure how much they want me to share, but they're not here to stop me. So, you know, again, I live in the buckle of the Bible Belt. I'm a very insular person. I don't really talk about my spiritual practices a lot because I don't want to be the second crucifixion. You know, I would just rather keep the peace. You know, most of my family either knows, but just we have a tacit agreement not to talk about it, or they don't know and they probably never will. So when we were discussing getting the book out there and launched, we had looked at a couple different options, most of them a couple hours drive away from here. And we were bouncing around ideas, and Blake was like, hey, listen, if we're already talking about travel, why don't we just fly you up here and we'll do the launch party here? Okay, you know, that's that works for me. So, and they did. And it was a nightmare because I'm a difficult person. We were trying to coordinate it with our personal schedules. But even when I was slightly pickier about the hotel choice, you know, with our schedule, they were like, well, you know, it's not what we had in mind, but we have this place over here. And they've just been absolutely wonderful. All the illustrations in the book, the cover, all that, that's all Wick. He illustrated all of that, which, you know, is part of the royalty. Like, there, that's, I guess, what I pay them for. I don't know. he did all the illustrations, and he shot everything past me and said, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? You know, and like the sigils in the back of the book, some of those are hand designed. Some of those I digitally generated because I couldn't get the look I wanted by hand. He took all those and made them look absolutely fantastic. That just the whole process has been fantastic from start to end. I do know for a fact that my book is number one in their pre-sales. It's doing pretty decent. They've done a great job of marketing. Francesca's been absolutely wonderful with, you know, reaching out to people and arranging interviews and, you know, handling the marketing, getting it out there so people see it. They've all been fantastic. Like, if you are an aspiring author, I would definitely recommend working with Crossed Crow. Just based on my one experience with them has been this awesome that I will probably be republishing my second book and then doing all my other ones with them.
That's amazing. I loved your book. I mean, I've said it so many times throughout this interview, but it's a wonderful work. It really is. It's, you know, I found it because of Blake and Wick, and I think that their store is incredible. And I was just informed by Francesca at Cross Crow before our interview today that your book is getting a limited edition hardcover release.
It is.
That's really cool. It's beautiful.
Oh my God. Did she show you?
Yeah. I got a link to the cover, and it's gorgeous. It's so good.
And again, that's Wick. They shot me a couple ideas, and I said, well, I like, you know, I like this one. But I like this one too, and I can't. Maybe we could put them both together. And he was like, "I got you, fam." And like, oh, it came out so well. Like, I'm very happy for the hardcover.
Yeah. So there are going to be 200 copies of that. I'm not sure what the metrics are for how fast they're pre-selling, but I will leave a link to where you can get it in the show notes of this episode.
Yeah, I personally am going to be picking up at least two copies. One for my house copy, one for some close friends of mine. I am probably going to get my hands on some of those copies. So if they do sell out, like they're her backdoor avenues, but I can't even guarantee that mine will be held on that long. Cause I have a pile of people right now asking to get the book, and they don't want to go through Amazon or third party. They want to come to me. So I would definitely jump on the hardcover as soon as you can, because they're probably going to be gone quickly.
It's no surprise to me that the book's been popular enough to warrant getting a special edition. How do you feel about the response to the book so far?
Everything I've seen has, like, I deal with imposter syndrome, like, really hard with this. And even with the first edition, the moment I hit publish, I was like, oh God, I'm a fraud. I've just regurgitated information that's been in the public knowledge for the last 20, 30 years, blah, 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 blah. And even now with the second release, I'm still blown away. People love it this much. We did a question and answer session at the shop for the launch party. I don't know, I guess I'm used to dealing with boring people, but I was so excited at some of the questions that were being asked. Like, I could have written an entirely new chapter on some of the things we discussed there, just because it was, you know, people were asking real questions, like, good question. It's humbling to see people being this open and receptive to it. I've just been blown away by how people have taken it. I haven't heard any negative reviews yet. I would love to hear where I could improve. I'm trying to phrase this in a way that doesn't make me sound like an arrogant ass, but so far I have only heard good things from the people that have read it. So
that makes sense to me. It's a great read. And this is coming from somebody who like trashes witchy stuff for fun. like our whole podcast is about like making fun of things. And I genuinely was thinking as we were prepping for the interview, I was like, well, should I make a joke? Should I? And I just couldn't think of anything because it's just all such good information. It was a wonderful read. And I'm so, so glad that we got to have you on the pod. It was nice to meet you.
Oh, me too.
I didn't get a chance to go to the question and answer party. I'm in Chicago as well. Yeah, I go to the shop all the time. I'm there pretty frequently, but I didn't get a chance to come and like see you. So this was really cool for me to be able to like read the book and then get to meet the author and sort of have that opportunity on my own. So thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Oh, of course. It was a pleasure. And, you know, don't feel bad. There were members of my own house who I messaged beforehand to say, hey, you know, I'm going to be in Chicago on this day. And they messaged me the day after. And we're like, oh, I can't believe I missed this message. So like, it's okay. But if you do want to make fun of one of my books, the second one I got an outline of it and got an idea out and then realized I was hitting a deadline. So I just hit publish and have regretted it ever since. So read that one and then we can come on here and you can make fun of it.
Oh, okay. Sounds good. You know what? If you republish that second book, we will have another episode and we'll chat about it and I'll just read you for filth. How's that sound?
I'm here for it.
All right, Nog. Well, thank you very much for being here. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you'd like to touch on before we end our little session here?
You know, just the usual. If anybody has questions, comments, criticisms, reviews, etc., pretty easy to find. Email address is noglokishivanath@gmail.com because I'm super creative. but I do have a Facebook page that I share on occasion, especially news about the book, which is what most of it is. And Francesca does not like the fact that I do not share very often, but but I do have a Facebook page. If anybody wants to follow along, it links over to my more professional presence that is only moderately more active. other than that, I think we covered a good deal.
Amazing. Well, that is super wonderful to hear. I'm glad that it was expansive enough. If you are located in the Chicago area and would like to purchase the book, you can do so at the Malloway Bros Spells, Charms, and Potions Shop located at 1407 West Morse Avenue in Chicago. If you aren't so fortunate to be in the Chicago area, you can purchase it through a third party like Amazon, but if you want to support a local business and a small publishing company, you can order it at crosscrowbooks.com directly from the publisher. Don't forget to place your pre-order for the special edition hardcover before they sell out. That absolutely will happen, so do it quickly. I really enjoyed this. I would love to have you on again sometime, maybe as a guest on one of our media episodes if you'd like.
Sure.
Would you like to do the sign off with me? So we have like a little bit that we do at the end where we'll say, all right, all you, some sort of insult. Until next time, keep on witching and bitching. So if you would like to do that with me, you're welcome to do the and bitching and say goodbye with me.
I'm down for it.
All right, all you corpse water drinking necromancers. Until next time, keep on witching.
And bitching.
Bye.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?